This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Furniture production played an important part in the rich history of North Carolina. High Point has been at the center of the market for more than a century. But the industry looks much different than it did just a few decades ago. Changes in global economics sent manufacturing overseas. The most recent casualty is the Stanley Furniture Company. Stanley Furniture closed its plant in Robbinsville last month. And we're talking about furniture today. We're going to begin with Robbinsville, and we want to hear from you if you have close ties to the furniture industry. Give us a call at 877-962-9862, and you can shed some light on this with a personal story, 877-962-9862. You can send us a tweet at hashtag SOTFurniture. Dale Neal is a reporter for the Asheville Citizen-Times, and he joins us now from the studios of WCQS in Asheville. Dale, welcome to the State of Things.
Oh, thanks, Frank. Glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about Stanley Furniture. That plant is closing down this year. Tell us about, let's get a picture now. Tell us about Robbinsville in Graham County.
Robbinsville is about maybe 100 miles or so southwest of Asheville. Folks who might have been coming up through Asheville, you have to get way off the interstate to get to Robbinsville, way over the mountain. Small community, Graham County. Graham County historically has one of the worst unemployment rates in the state. So when Stanley Furniture announced in April that they were going to be closing down this plant, 400 people losing their jobs, that's a big chunk of workforce out there. And Stanley was the last major manufacturer for that community. What was interesting, though, is that Stanley had made a significant investment in that particular plant in recent years. They were trying to actually bring back manufacturing from China. A great deal of their business has gone overseas, of course, in recent years, but they'd made a calculated bet that nursery and young people's furniture could be made here in America. Because people were worried about, you know, the finishes, the pollution, the toxins that they were reading about coming on Chinese-made products. So Robbinsville was at the heart of what Stanley called their Young America furniture line. And Stanley had invested somewhere around $9 million in recent years. Lots of high-tech sort of machinery and systems into that particular plant. So it came as a real shock, I think, to that community when Stanley said, oh, these numbers aren't adding up. We are going to have to close this down again.
Well, shocking, because for a while that bet was paying off. Stanley was profitable until only a couple of years ago, right?
Exactly. But looking at the financials, the picture might not have been as rosy for them. A lot of the profits they were reporting in 2012 was coming from, you know, anti-dumping claims. They were able to get some money back for, you know, in these settlements against overseas manufacturers. So they had $39 million sort of added to their bottom line in 2012. They weren't able to show that kind of a figure in the following year, 2013, and all of a sudden they were showing losses. You know, that calculated the bet they had made. They were warning in the financials that the Robbinsville plant was at risk, that this maybe was not paying off for them.
So how long had Stanley been in Graham County?
They had been there since about 1985. That plant itself goes back to the 60s. It actually started as a carpet mill, and then the previous manufacturer, furniture manufacturer, had come in there. But Stanley came into that community in 1985, and it was the top employer for that community for, you know, nearly 30 years. Most people I've talked to, in the elected officials and such, the mayor, for example, he'd worked for them at least twice at various times in his career. So that whole plant has had sort of, I wouldn't say a checkered history, but it goes back to the idea that there used to be layoffs at that plant, mm-hmm. you know, previously, but it was back in the days when a layoff was for a few months. Workers would get notice, but they would get hired back, you know, when the business picked back up in a few, in, you know, that summer or whatever. So people were used to ups and downs, but I don't think they were used to just the plant completely closing down.
Well,
particularly after
so many years, I'm forgiving for
cutting particularly you off. After that kind of recent investment, the $9 million bet that Stanley had made in that particular facility.
Well, you talked about the fact that it had been a carpet factory before this, going back to the 1960s, and that suggests there's a manufacturing ecosystem in that part of the state as well, because you don't just open a plant in the middle of nowhere. You have to have the support for manufacturing that is required to keep it going. Isn't that right?
Exactly. I mean, Western North Carolina, most people who aren't from this area don't realize how much industry has been a part of the mountains for, you know, actually the past century. Textiles and furniture in particular, but also electronics and other fields. But back at the turn of, you know, the 20th century, textile mill owners up in New England started looking for cheaper labor. In a sense, the South was the China of that day. They were trying to get away from unions and higher wages. They brought textile plants down to our region. And so we have a long history of huge sort of mill villages built around blanket mills, you know, textile mills, and, of course, furniture. Add that to tobacco. You know, the mountains is particularly known for, you know, burley tobacco. So you had those mainstays of the North Carolina economy, you know, in spades here in the mountains itself, burley tobacco, textiles, and furniture. And that has been changing in the last 25 years, of course.
And with the closing of the Stanley plant, we're talking about 400 jobs again in Graham County, not a very large county. What kind of impact is that going to have?
Well, it's we haven't seen it play out yet. A lot of these folks are going through retraining. There's resources out there where folks in community colleges and financial counselors have gone forward and tried to help these folks out. There is still a lot of business up here as far as, you know, hospitality and leisure jobs. You know, since the recession, leisure and hospitality has actually led the way in the recovery that we have been experiencing. Now, the problem is in Graham County, their unemployment reached as high as 20% in February 2012. It's still the highest unemployment in Western North Carolina at 9.8% in June. But there are opportunities out there. Talked with the county manager. He's hearing of people who are landing jobs. Harris Casino, of course, is a large employer in the county next door. The tribe, you know, the Eastern Band of Cherokee, are also opening up another casino to the county, you know, below them in Murphy.
We're talking about the furniture industry in North Carolina on the State of Things. Dale Neal's a reporter for the Asheville Citizen-Times. He's talking about the closing of the Stanley Furniture plant in Graham County. What's going to happen to that plant, Dale?
It's not quite clear. County officials are remaining optimistic. They've had some. Stanley still owns the plant. This is the last plant that Stanley Furniture directly owns in the U.S. Stanley's been around since 1924, started in, you know, what is Stanley Town, Virginia. All its other domestic operations and warehouses, you know, the company actually is leasing now. So I think, you know, Stanley is looking for a buyer. We've heard that, you know, Ashley Furniture has gone through and looked at it, maybe some others. But no deals seem to be in the offing right now. County manager remains hopeful that someone will come in and, again, make this a manufacturing center for that community.
You talked a little bit about elected officials, commissioners in Graham County, and the mayor. The fact that there are some other jobs available, that they've told you that other jobs are available. What about retraining? And the other question is whether people are leaving the county. I mean, that'll lower your unemployment rate, sadly.
Yeah. It's not quite clear. Again, Graham has always had this sort of – it's a small county. Most of that land is really sort of federal land, so it's a small tax base. But, you know, Joyce Kilmer, you know, Wilderness is up there, butts up against the Great Smoky Mountains. There's a lot of national forests up there. So all that is federal land, basically. There's only a few sort of pockets of private industry and such left. There's still, you know, a lot of – most – Graham County is now the largest employer in that community, along with the school system. There is still some construction there. But there are people driving elsewhere for jobs. You know, not everybody walks to work anymore. So, and the mayor did point that out, is that, you know, this doesn't just affect Graham County, but all the surrounding counties too. So that unemployment rate we would expect to see might be spread out somewhat. Of course, it's going to be hard hit for everybody out there. But there is still pockets of manufacturing still left. they might have to drive a little bit further for it.
And all of this comes at a time when we see cuts in state spending, particularly for support in social programs. What kind of impact is that going to have, do you think?
Well, of course, you know, it trickles out. You know, when you start having when your largest, you know, tax base sort of goes away there, you know, the mayor, you know, Steve Hooper of Robbinsville said, you know, well, this town could probably expect, you know, at least an $80,000 hit in tax revenues, you know, water and sewer bills, that sort of thing, revenues. Of course, that trickles out to the rest of the community. You talk about, you know, how do the restaurants do, the diners, the hardware stores, you know, those little service industry, service businesses that still exist, even in a small town like Robbinsville. It's a trickle-out effect. We haven't seen the worst of it, I think, unfortunately, in Graham County. This could be a real hard winter for those folks.
All right, Dale. Thank you very much. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, Frank.
Dale Neal is a reporter for the Asheville Citizen Times. We're talking about the furniture market in North Carolina, furniture manufacturing. Some of it has gone away. Some of it is coming back. We'll take a look at efforts to bring furniture back to North Carolina and some missed opportunities for the furniture industry. As our conversation continues, we want to hear from you. If you have stories or in some way we're connected with the furniture industry and have stories to tell, call us at 877-962-9862 on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Tobacco is history in North Carolina. So is furniture, but it's coming back. Today we're talking about the state of furniture and the industry in North Carolina, taking your calls as well. If you were ever part of that business, you worked at a plant around somewhere in the state, give us a call, 877-962-9862. Send us a tweet, hashtag SOT Furniture, or an email, sot@wnc.org. Joining our conversation now is Giulio Buccini. He's a visiting scholar at Duke University's Center on Globalization, Governance, and Competitiveness. Giulio, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Beth Macy, who is the author of Factory Man, a book about the history of the Bassett Furniture Company in Virginia and North Carolina. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Great to be here.
It's good to have you. And Scott McGee is the owner of Bull City Designs, a custom design furniture company right here in Durham. Hi, Scott.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
It's good to have you. Giulio, let's talk a little bit about, kind of get some of the context of the history industry. You heard Dale talk about some of the history of the industry. It was cheap labor, I guess, that brought that industry here. Tell us more about what brought manufacturing to North Carolina and how important an industry it was to the state.
Well, first of all, it is indeed about cheap labor. The biggest industrialization process of this industry took place actually in the past century when the large supply of wood from local forest and cheap labor force coming from agriculture were the main sources of competitive advantage for local firms who actually took over the production of furniture for the mass market that was previously performed in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and in Cincinnati. So cheap labor, It's a sort of a fun story because cheap labor was back in recent years the discriminating factor that many firms use to move production overseas. But back in the 30s of the past century, this was absolutely the first, the most important source of competitive advantage for local firms.
All right. So what changed and when did it change for this industry in North Carolina?
Well, if we look at the main internationalization process that the industry of North Carolina had been experiencing, the mid-late 90s is a key point.
Yeah.
2001, though, I would say is the most important year as China entered the WTO, the World Trade Organization.
And furniture was a little slow to sort of catch on in the whole globalization effort, as I understand. Why did it take the furniture industry so long to move offshore?
Well, perhaps it took longer than other industries, but when firms started to outsource, trust me that it played out in a sort of a domino game. So in 10 years, we the North Carolina furniture industry lost as many as 40,000 jobs.
Wow.
So
it was fast when it finally caught on.
It was fast.
Well, not every manufacturer left for China. And Beth Macy, your book starts with the Bassett family. It talks about you spent years researching the Bassett Furniture Company, the town of Bassett, one of many that grew around the factory in the Appalachian Mountains. Tell us about that factory and sort of how it grew and why it survived.
Sure. And it's important to start out saying there's two different companies that are featured in my book. Bassett Furniture began in 1902 for the same reasons we've been talking about in Henry County, Virginia: cheap labor and plentiful woods. J.D. Bassett Sr. basically built a furniture factory along the Smith River, which he harnessed for power, you know, in his front yard. And it grew into the largest wood manufacturer in the world, you know, hugely important after when the baby boom hit and new American suburbs began and people needed bedroom furniture for all those new bedrooms. And as Julio was just describing, you know, of course, when China joined the WTO in 2001, it was supposed to be a win-win and that we were going to be exporting jobs for back to the growing consumer class in China. And I think we all know when we drive through these little former factory towns that didn't really happen. And what my book is about a Bassett, a third-generation Bassett heir named John Bassett III, who actually runs a company called Vaughn Bassett just across the border in Galax, Virginia, from North Carolina. And in 2003, he filed what was at the time the world's largest anti-dumping petition against China after going there sort of covertly and finding a factory in northern China where he was just sure they were dumping. And that means they were selling it at less than the cost of even the goods to make the furniture in an effort to capture the American market share and make the American furniture makers close their factories.
So he looked and noticed right away that I think the point you make in the book is that this had been going on and everybody was pretty sure that this must be happening, that they can't be selling this for more than, you know, what they're actually making it. And yet he was the guy who actually pursued the suit and began to win the claim, right?
Exactly. Yeah. He won a 6-0 vote by the U.S. International Trade Commission in 2005 and then again at the Sunset hearing in 2010. And he proved, you know, that they were not following the rules that they had agreed to when they joined the WTO. They were dumping. There was some currency manipulation and also Chinese government subsidies, which the factory owner in northern China basically admitted that, you know, they were being supported by their government.
So holding China to the rules of the game is one of the secrets to success. But the other is innovation and adaptation. Tell us how the Bassetts made the turn and made the adjustment to global economic pressures.
Sure. John Bassett is a really relentless guy. He was thought when he was born in 1937 that he would one day run Bassett Furniture Industries. He could not get along with his older brother-in-law, Bob Spillman, who ended up beating him to the job and kicking him to the curb, some would say. And so in 1982, he decamped for Galax, Virginia, to work for his wife's company's family company called Vaughn Bassett. And some say, you know, he's just got this fighting spirit because of what had happened to him and this desire to sort of prove to the folks back in Bassett who the real factory man was. And I think that's part of it. I also think part of it is just, you know, we're going to hold their feet to the fire. They need to play by the rules. Sure, they have the advantage of cheap labor over in China, but when they're breaking the rules that they've agreed to play by, you know, somebody needs to call him on it. The other thing he did is he didn't just say, what's China doing? He said, what can we do that's different? And how can we compete against the weeks it takes the furniture to come across the ocean? And so he invented this new speed delivery system that really catered to the mom and pops that were really suffering from the globalization because they couldn't afford to import entire containers of furniture. So he designed the system where if you were a small store in a small town in America, you could order just one or two suits of his furniture and you could have it delivered in 5 days, 7 days at the latest. And that was really kind of his end run around. And, you know, he just tweaked he still tweaks. He's in that factory every day at age 76, sort of tweaking and making the sawdust fly.
Giulio Buccini, you talk about this in some of your work, the fact that there are adjustments that other manufacturers could have made. This was a decision by American manufacturers to go offshore. The other decision was to stay and compete, as Bassett did, and succeeded.
Right. Unfortunately, the majority of firms just decide to leave the state and to relocate production offshore. But again, this was their strategy, and it was not a mandatory strategy. It was an option. A brief overview of the basic competition rule of this industry. This is a mature manufacturing industry where R&D investments are low compared to other major industries in the United States, and where customers are fairly price sensitive. So essentially, what firms could do in order to decrease production costs is either investing in new technology equipment, so to increase their productivity, or to move production to cheaper suppliers. And when China entered WTO, many companies just found it easier to simply relocate production offshore without even facing foreign direct investment. In fact, many of the production that the Chinese perform is performed in an independent manner. So that's I think it's the core of this story. It's not about blaming Chinese firms. As a matter of fact, we still in the U.S. today don't have any Chinese brands competing in the furniture. It is about companies in North Carolina not being willing to invest in technology and in new equipment.
Right. And what John Bassett did, I guess, is a demonstration that it just might have worked had they stayed here and innovated, and they could have competed as well.
It can, but we also got to make sure that people understand the deep meaning of this investment. It's not just about investing in new equipment and production. In many cases, you may have to review the way you manage your whole value chain, meaning you might end up competing in a different niche of the market, targeting more sophisticated customers that expect you to be able to communicate the premium price that they might end up paying for.
So this would be the buy American, buy local, that sort of marketing pitch that you're going to have to make to communicate to your customers that this is a special product.
It is. And let me also point out that when I say manage the entire value chain, I do also include designs, because in many cases, sophisticated consumers want customized products, and customized products requires somebody who designed this product. So it's a real new approach that firms have to take in order to be competitive by retaining production locally.
Scott McGee, that sounds like a little bit about what you're doing here in Durham with your company. Tell us about your firm and what you're doing.
So Bull City Design started in 2011, and originally when we entered the market, we were looking to focus on the residential sector, kind of focus on dining tables, small pieces. But eventually, being in Durham, there's just so much growth around here, we started focusing our attention on commercial products, restaurants, business offices, things of that nature.
So how big a company, how many people are working for you?
Right now, we have 5 people working for us.
Well, and you make all the furniture right here. So you design it and you make it right in Durham.
So we do everything in-house. There is some collaboration with local metal artisans around the area. But as far as the design process and the manufacturing, we do everything in-house.
How long have you been in business?
Since 2011.
All right. And so how has business changed for you? Is it picking up? Have you stayed fairly level?
Absolutely. Really, at the beginning, things were slow, and that's because we were just trying to find our footing in the area. But as we started to meet more people and make connections, you know, word of mouth began to spread, and we're really starting to see that, especially this year.
Well, I'm guessing you don't compete well on price, say, with IKEA.
No, definitely not. No one really can compete with IKEA.
And how are your Swedish meatballs, may I ask? But people are paying a premium price. They're paying more for your stuff.
Absolutely.
It's made by a few people in Durham, and it's been shipped out. Why do you think they're doing that?
I think that people these days are really into, you know, having something that's actually unique in their home. I think that, you know, maybe people are moving away from, you know, you can go to different people's houses and you may see the same furniture in different houses. And I feel like people are kind of gravitating towards the idea of, using their furniture as a reflection of them and kind of, you know, really liking to put that extra thought into what they're purchasing.
Beth Macy, when it comes to Bassett furniture, is the market now mostly a U.S. market, or is there much in the way of exports?
No, Vaughan Bassett is selling in the U.S. and I think a little bit in Canada as well.
Giulio, you talked a little bit about this supply, this management chain, this larger sort of management ecosystem that has to be developed. Would that include expertise in export? Are there export markets for U.S. manufacturers to have?
Oh, absolutely, Frank. I think this is actually the next big challenge, an opportunity for North Carolina firms in manufacturing and in furniture industry. In terms of expertise, I would say yes. This is where I see actually private and public institution to cooperate together. Exports require skills, especially when you target new developing countries that don't really have our same mentality and same business procedure. Although I think another great opportunity in this sense comes from the already existing connection that many local firms have in China. So China is a country today known for its growing middle upper class, made of people that want to buy Western brands, and they are not willing to buy made in China products. So that's a great opportunity. And still, though, the value of the export generated by this industry is very low.
So you're saying that the low expertise in the export business or the export aspect of manufacturing is limited U.S. exports of furniture abroad. There is a market to be had. And the fact that we're there now working within China means that we should have some a leg up, or we've entered the market. Are other countries taking advantage of this? Do you see examples of other countries exporting successfully to China?
You know, looking at the international marketplace, particularly in the furniture industry, firms from Germany and from Italy are those that have been able to carve out successfully a new niche of market globally. So I would probably use some of a few successful firms from this country as a benchmark, in a way to show and to understand better how can a firm that has traditionally sold its product in a domestic market, like happened to many firms in the United States, start approaching a new mentality and a new attitude towards foreign.
Scott, where are your customers? Are they local, national? Do you have any exports?
We don't have any exports, but we definitely have shipped all over the country. A lot of the major cities kind of cater towards the designs that come off of our website. But we've definitely been pushing a lot locally over the last year.
You're a young man, and this is an industry that by the time I would guess you had made a decision to get into it, it had already been going the wrong direction. How did you get into it, and what's your expertise and why?
I got into it because I saw the need to produce furniture, you know, responsibly, and to kind of push the edge more from a design standpoint. You know, I started working for another furniture company several years back, and that's where I met my business partner, Abraham Uribe, and he's an exceptional craftsman. And together we kind of formed the company. And, you know, since then we've just been kind of feeling out how we want to attack the residential high-end market and focusing more locally right now.
So, Beth, you get the idea of how this, if we want to attack it as a niche market, we can do it. Bassett, Vaughan Bassett, obviously, is a more traditional manufacturer. Are they looking at these innovations in design as well as simply cost efficiencies as a way of being competitive?
They are looking to, as the old saying goes, sell to the masses, eat with the classes. I mean, they are still kind of looking to be the leader, the leading domestic producer in the mass market. And, you know, they are tweaking their designs. They have new designs that come out every high point market. But they're not trying to get in the high end because, you know, as they say in Virginia, you don't forget who brought you to the dance. So they're staying loyal to their customers.
Staying in their wheelhouse, as it were. Giulio Buccini, yeah. What's the future for – do you see the expansion in niche markets, or is there a chance for a kind of industrial manufacturing to revive in some way here in the U.S.?
I think it's a chance for both of these business models. I like to think about this industry as a very complex industry. So I think that there might be room for multiple business models. Of course, what we've been hearing from Bassett is a very nice story that really shows how you can remain in U.S. and being competitive, even if you don't target a sophisticated niche of market. On the other hand, though, I see room for new entrepreneurs or existing firms, perhaps on a smaller scale, to penetrate more profitable upper class of consumers.
Giulio Buccini, visiting scholar at Duke Center on Globalization, Governance, and Competitive. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Beth Macy is the author of Factory Man, about the history of Bassett Furniture Company. Thank you, Beth.
Thank you so much.
Scott McGee, owner of Bull City Designs, a small furniture company in Durham, North Carolina. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
And thank all of you for being on the program. Of course, as always, you can go to the website stateofthings.org for more. And there's more just ahead, a novel about a secret fragrance with magic powers. Stay tuned.